Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned. Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Greetings. I got on the air a little late here. Probably caused some consternation. Sometimes there's too many interesting things going on out in the world and in my own world. My show today, though, should be one of the most interesting and informative. I'm going to be talking with Joanna Moncrief. Joanna is a premier psychiatrist. She is beyond being a psychiatrist and is a genuine physician and researcher and thinker in the field. I haven't had her on the show for a while, but in keeping with my new idea of having my really best guests on more often, you'll be hearing more from Joanna if she consents. Now, to get a premier psychiatrist, I have to go to Great Britain. Joanna, are you there?
I'm here. Yes. Hello, Peter.
Hi. Joanna is, and this doesn't mean much to me and probably won't to most of you, is a reader in critical and social psychiatry at the University College in London. I'd like her to actually explain that to us. And she works as a consultant in community psychiatry at the North East London Foundation Trust. She is, I think, kind of a member of the British psychiatric community. That would be interesting also to learn about. Joanna's newest book, an excellent book, a very good book, is Bitterest Pills, The Troubling Story of Antipsychotic Drugs. She's also the author of The Myth of the Chemical Cure and A Straight-Talking Introduction to Psychiatric Drugs. These are really good books. And she's also co-editor of Demedicalizing Misery, volumes, I guess, 1 and 2. I've known Joanna for a long time. Perhaps she can give the date, but way back, I was invited to Great Britain to debate with her as a co-debater, two of the most outstanding psychiatrists they could manage to come up with in Great Britain. It was organized by our friend Bob Johnson, who was a psychiatrist in Great Britain. And I think it was held, or I don't know, was it held at the BBC or some other prestigious place? But Joanna and I demolished the poor souls that they put up to debate us. What year was that, Joanna? Do you have any recollection?
I can't remember either, but maybe about, maybe 2002, 2004, something like that. Yeah. It was held at the... it was put on by the Guardian newspaper. They sponsored it, and we were introduced by the editor of the Guardian newspaper. Yeah,
And they still do it. We still see interesting things here in the U.S. politically and scientifically that the Guardian grabs onto.
Oh, yeah.
Well, things are more exciting in Great Britain than in the U.S. when it comes to critical psychiatry. and it is the home of the Critical Psychiatry Network, which Joanna was a co-founder of a number of years back. There's nothing like a Critical Psychiatry Network in the U.S., although I do belong to the British network, and occasionally I say something or another on that email system for communicating among people who have a critical view and some who don't have much of a critical view on psychiatry. I've never asked Joanna how she became a critical psychiatrist, and also what is your place now, would you say, in psychiatry in Great Britain?
Yeah, good question, Peter. To take the second question first, I think psychiatry in Great Britain is quite interesting, and there are many fairly mainstream psychiatrists who have some sympathy with critical psychiatry, you know, who are generally thoughtful people who would accept some of our criticisms, but maybe not all. But then, of course, there are also many who don't want to hear the criticisms or don't want to think too much about them. So I suppose I'm sort of reluctantly accepted into in psychiatry in Great Britain. Sometimes I'm listened to, and most of the time I'm ignored. But to take your first question about when I first became a critical psychiatrist, I was thinking about this recently, and I have to confess to always having been a bit of a rebel. So when I was a medical student, I was reading Thomas Sasz and R.D. Lang and thinkers like that before I got to psychiatric hospitals to get some clinical experience. And then when I started working as a junior psychiatrist, I realized that all these sort of 1960s books that I'd been reading, which were suggesting that, you know, this terrible capitalist state was locking lots of people up who weren't really mad, I realized that that wasn't true, that wasn't the case. But nevertheless, the mainstream idea that these people had an illness that was the same as having pneumonia or something like that, and they came into hospital and they could easily get better with treatment, I realized that that wasn't true either, that what led people to end up in psychiatric hospital was much, much more complex than that, that it wasn't really helpful to describe it as an illness, that almost always it related to other things that had been going on in their lives. And that helping these people was much more complicated than giving them a pill and them getting better. It just wasn't like that. And I remember one of the biggest revelations really was seeing these people, because we used to use very high doses of antipsychotic drugs both in Europe and the United States. And so the old psychiatric hospitals were full of these people shuffling along corridors. You may remember this yourself, you know, with really severe drug-induced Parkinsonism. It's a condition like Parkinson's disease, which is induced by antipsychotic drugs. And the hospitals were full of these people who were supposed to be better. They were supposed to be cured by the drugs, but they clearly were still very impaired. And I think it was that really started me to sparked up the ideas that I've been developing ever since.
When did you come across my work? When Toxic was published in Great Britain?
I was trying to remember that. So was it published? It was published in the early 90s.
Yeah, about 91 or 2 in Great Britain it came out with a special edition.
So I remember that I had heard about it, that it was a famous book before I got to read it. So it must have been out for a year or two. So I probably didn't read it until about 1993 or something like that, by which time I'd been working as a psychiatrist. I was still a junior psychiatrist, but I'd been working in psychiatry about 3 years. And I remember reading it and thinking, yes, this is what I'm seeing. You know, it started to make sense of what I was seeing in front of me, of these people with these neurological problems that had been brought on by the drug treatment they were taking, which everyone else and all the textbooks of psychiatry were just glossing over most of the time.
Yeah, yeah. And did you begin to talk about these things with your colleagues way back then? And what kind of response did you get?
We talked to some extent. And I mean, I remember I'm still friends with some of the people I trained with, and they were generally quite a thoughtful bunch. And actually, I remember talking to a slightly more senior psychiatrist about antidepressants one day and saying, you know, I just can't convince myself that they're really making people better. And he said, oh, of course they're not making people better. They're just an active placebo, he said. They're just a placebo with some side effects. And that was the first time I'd come across that idea. So that was from another psychiatrist I was training with. And then I started looking at the literature and finding out that actually other people had suggested this idea as well, that antidepressants were placebos with side effects. Which probably didn't have any specific effect on any symptoms of depression.
So all of which has been ignored. It's quite stunning how we give what are essentially neurotoxins to people, and we're doing it more and more and for lesser and lesser causes. And if one were to just read a neurotoxicology book and look at what neurotoxins do to the brain, you'd find that the book was actually often talking about psychiatric drugs. If there wasn't a psychiatric co-author, it's just an ordinary author, you know, they'll be talking about the toxic effects of psychiatric drugs in the same way they talk about other, quote, neurotoxins. I don't know if in your maturity now, we're both maturing some, me more than you, chronologically. You've got any more thoughts, John, on how does an institution persist in doing something harmful? It's a lot to drop on you, and we can skip on to something else. But, I mean, I just wonder how I'm still puzzling over. It's got to be something just inherent in human nature, the acceptance of whatever social role gives you power and authority. Maybe that's the essence of it, that whether it's the priest in the Spanish Inquisition, or whether it's the bureaucrat in Nazi Germany, the judges, that if you have a position of authority and gives you income and a role, you'll just about do anything that comes with the position, it seems. I mean, is that enough of an explanation?
I think psychiatrists have always been insecure about their medical credentials, and being able to dole out drug treatment helps them to feel more secure about that. And I think when you challenge something like particularly antidepressants, that does make many psychiatrists feel very insecure, because then they feel, well, I've got nothing particularly specifically medical to give all these people who are flooding into my office. I do think that's a significant factor. I probably have slightly different views with you on antipsychotics, because although I don't think they do anything specific, I think it can sometimes be helpful for someone who's really acutely psychotic to be dampened down a bit with these drugs. So although I don't think they're curing any underlying disorder, I think they can have a useful pharmacological effect. And that you probably therefore need, particularly because antipsychotic drugs are so toxic, you do need people who are very well trained to help supervise using them. So I think there is some, you know, I think there is a legitimate role for people who are medically qualified to be involved in some areas of treatment of psychiatric problems.
Yes, we probably do differ. But it also occurs to me that if instead short-term use of sedatives, there are old studies showing way back that benzos used short-term did as much good as the antipsychotics, and short term they're going to cause so much less problems and potential catastrophes. So I'd say if we could do anything, you know, do a lot of kindness and take care of people out in the country, and if they need a sleeping pill or a little sedative, if that's what they choose. But the antipsychotics, they're so toxic.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you. And I really think we ought to be looking into treatment of, you know, acute psychosis and acute mania with short-term sedatives, if anything. I mean, you'd try and contain people and get them through it without. But if they had to have something, trying just to use sedatives and not start antipsychotics. I think we ought to do a proper randomized control trial looking at that with some decent numbers of patients, because as you say, there are some old trials which generally suggest the sedatives were just as good, don't they?
Yeah, I think it was Baldessarini out of Harvard, I could be mistaken, who very early on was dispelling this idea that the antipsychotics were specific for psychosis at all, and secondly, that you could help people find a week or two more to calm down more using the sedatives. But anyway, you're on the cutting edge of actually doing research in a way that I can't, because I would not be allowed into a hospital setting for obvious reasons, because I would feel obliged to tell all the patients what the drugs were doing. If I meet a patient, I feel obliged to tell them what I know about the harmful effects if they have informed consent. So it's kind of hard to imagine anybody inviting me onto the wards anymore. By the way, on one of my trips, which I think it was an earlier trip than to you, and I debated a psychiatrist in his local hometown in Great Britain, and he didn't fare very well, according to the audience vote at the end. In fact, he didn't fare at all. But one of the things is I stopped in the local hospital, and I sat on the ward, and I talked to the nurses, and I asked them if they knew anything about tardive dyskinesia, and they knew a little bit. They told me they didn't have any patients with TD. And I said, well, sitting here, I see three or four.
Can I
give you a little seminar? Yeah. And they did. And we had all the patients come over, and I think about what usually happens, maybe a third, one out of two of the patients, about half of them had clear signs of tardive dyskinesia. Yeah. And it was just a revelation to the people on the ward. So people just don't see it.
Dyskinesia is, shouldn't we, Peter? So tardive dyskinesia is this movement disorder that people get after they've been taking antipsychotic treatment for a while. And it usually involves the face, and it's like a sort of flickering of the lips or the tongue, or twitching or lip smacking, sort of repetitive, involuntary movements. And it can affect the rest of the body, but usually just the face. But the thing that is really significant about it, that you've said before, but is one of these things that has been ignored, is that it persists when you stop the drugs, in some cases at least. And it's not just a movement disorder. It is associated in studies with some cognitive impairment, with some intellectual impairment. So the best study was done by an Irish group, and they followed up people and showed that as they developed the movement disorder, you could also show a parallel decline in their cognitive functioning. So it's an indication that the drugs, when you're using them for a long time, do cause some brain damage in some people.
Yeah, I think of ultimately everybody gets injured, and we know that if you're on for a year, you start to get into the range of 5 to 8% cumulative with TD, and when you're on for many years, I have no doubt that there's damage. And let's talk about that. That's one of the subjects we wanted to look at. And you amazingly picked up on some early research that I did and actually acknowledged it, which warmed my heart, and have been looking at the question of atrophy of the brain on these drugs and trying to get a variety of authoritative bodies to let you give seminars to the psychiatrists about it. I'd love to hear you talk about your experience with that.
Yeah. So I've been trying to organise a symposium or a discussion at the main conference that happens in the UK for psychiatrists about recent evidence about the dangers of antipsychotics and the pros and cons of antipsychotics. And one of the issues I wanted to look at is this evidence that they cause brain shrinkage, brain atrophy. And you've been pointing this out for a long time, and it was absolutely ignored. And I think the sort of general attitude was, you know, it just can't be possible for our treatments to do anything as nasty as this. And then in 2005, there was a paper published which described an animal study where they'd taken macaque monkeys and they'd randomized half of them to have antipsychotic drugs and half of them to have a placebo injection, a dummy injection. And they found that after 18 months of treatment, the animals who'd been having the antipsychotic drugs had a 10% lighter brain than the other animals. So you can't say that the animals had schizophrenia and it was because of the schizophrenia they had the lighter brain. They were just ordinary macaque monkeys. And it was clearly the antipsychotic drugs that caused the brain shrinkage. So since that study, and there's been a little bit more evidence since then, and that study was done by a leading US researcher. So since that study, there's been a gradual acknowledgement that antipsychotics can cause brain shrinkage and might therefore be bad for the brain, although there's lots of people arguing that maybe it's a good thing that your brain shrinks, would you believe it?
Well, that goes back to the old days of lobotomy when they were very clear in their minds that many of them, that less brain was better for the patients. Walter Freeman wrote an editorial in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease saying that maybe they have too much IQ, and that's why lobotomy, and which he was the master of in America, he did 5,000 lobotomies. And Freeman just came up blatantly and said, you know, brain damage is good, less brain is good, less IQ can be good. And it got published in this major journal, and of course nobody ever got mean to him about it.
Yeah. And of course, as you've pointed out as well, you know, we know that antipsychotics cause cognitive impairment. If you give them to volunteers or you give them to animals, they're not as good at, as you say, they're neurotoxic. They slow up their mental processes. These animals, when they're taking these drugs or volunteers, are not as good at learning new information or using the information they've got. They're not as mentally alert and mentally capable. So to some extent, using the drugs is doing the same thing. It's knocking off people's brain functioning to an extent. And that's come out again in some recent research, which is related to the study I'm involved in doing, which shows that people who stay on long-term maintenance antipsychotic treatment don't seem to function as well in the long term as people who've at least had a go at trying to get off it, even if they've ended up back on some of the medication.
And what has happened with the, by the way, you've inspired me to go look back at my 1983 book, and I've got studies in here that I'm citing back to 1977, which I believed, and I know I was correct, were showing brain damage from these drugs back as far as 77 in humans.
Yeah.
Pneumoencephalographs, which were showing inflated ventricles, which meant shrinking tissue, and even psych testing that went along with it. I mean, going way, way back, which wouldn't have surprised the early promoters of the drugs, who you and I know, compared it to an encephalitis of the brain that was an epidemic around and after World War One. They knew it was having very similar effects to that epidemic, and they knew that epidemic was damaging the brain.
Yeah.
It's it's a lot to talk about. Maybe someday I could find a way to have you back to talk about the details of all of this. It's so icky but important, but probably not today. So what happened when you tried to get the British Academy of Psychiatry, if that's the proper name, when you tried to get them to do a seminar on brain atrophy studies?
So I had Robin Murray lined up to present data on brain atrophy studies. I mean, he's a leading psychiatrist, probably the leading psychiatrist in the UK, who has been doing some imaging studies of people on antipsychotics and has some data on this. And I had also invited over a Dutch psychiatrist called Lex Wonderink, who organized a very interesting antipsychotic withdrawal trial in people with first episode psychosis. And this was a study that followed people up long term and found that people who were on the drugs continuously on a long term basis weren't functioning as well as people who'd had a go at getting off them. And so I'd invited him over, and this Dutch study is such an important study because it's the only real long-term follow-up of a randomized control trial. So there are other studies that have shown that people who avoid long-term continuous treatment seem to do a bit better, but they're always criticized because people say, oh, well, those are the people who would have done better anyway. And the people who end up on the long-term medication are the people who would have done worse anyway. So the fact that this Dutch study had done a long-term follow-up after a randomization and still found that the people who were randomized to the long-term continuous treatment weren't doing as well is really important. So I'd invited him over and he'd agreed to come. And the conference committee decided that it wasn't interesting enough to go on the program. I was just staggered at that. You know, I had the leading psychiatrist in the UK, Robin Murray, lined up to present data on antipsychotics and brain structure, and the lead researcher of this really crucially important study from the Netherlands, and they didn't want me to do it. Anyway, I'm going to try again next year, and I'll tell you whether I get any result.
Well, if I don't have you on before then, which I think I will try to, if you're willing, certainly when you start to do that, whenever you want, just call and we'll have you back to find out what the latest to doing is. Now, is all of this material covered in The Bitterest Pill in your new book?
So The Bitterest Pill looks at the history of antipsychotic drugs. So it goes back to those early days in the 1950s when psychiatrists were first trying these drugs out and when they were really honest about what sort of things they were doing to people. And then it covers more recent times. So it looked at the introduction of the atypical antipsychotics, the sort of ropey research that that they were introduced on the basis of. And it looks at the expansion in prescribing that's gone on recently. So first of all, the new antipsychotics, the atypical antipsychotics, first of all, they took over the market for sort of severe mental illness, schizophrenia and psychosis, and they pushed out the old drugs to some extent anyway. But then they started to be marketed to new groups of people. And so one topic I cover is the topic of bipolar disorder, which was marketed to people who might otherwise have considered themselves to be depressed. And I think what you see happening in the latter part of the 1990s and more recently is the drug companies trying to capture some of the market for antidepressants, for the antipsychotics, because there are so many more people with these milder mental health problems like depression that they might be able to pull in if they can get a little slice of that market. So that's what the book covers. So and it didn't get up to, and it does cover the, it covers most of the recent data on the brain shrinkage and going back, it looks back at the data from when you were writing about it as well. But it doesn't get up to the Dutch study, which I just mentioned, because that's been published since I published, the follow-up of that study has been published since I published The Bitterest Pills. So I'll have to update it at some point, but I'll wait until I finish my study until I update it, I think.
Do me a favor, please, and either send me the link or the actual Irish study and the actual Dutch study.
Yes, I will, yeah.
I don't think I've read them.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about your research.
So yes, I'm very excited about this. So I have got funding to do a large antipsychotic withdrawal study, and it's going to be a randomized trial comparing people who are randomized to a gradual withdrawal program compared to people who are kept on maintenance treatment. And it's going to be for people who've had more than one episode of psychosis. So they might have had a couple of episodes, or they might have had lots of episodes. And it's going to be very large. We're hoping to get about 400 people into this study altogether, and it will last for about 5 years. So it's going to be a really big study. And it's being funded by, essentially, by the British government, by the research and development arm of the National Health Service. So I think the fact that they've funded this study indicates that there is increasing concern about the effects of antipsychotic drugs and the practice of just, you know, throwing them at people and then leaving them people on them for life, which is effectively what happens, isn't it? So we're just over 6 months into this project, and we've been doing some pilot work. The randomized control trial will start next year. And what we've been doing this year is we've been doing a big survey of patients who would potentially be eligible for the trial and asking them about essentially whether they'd be interested in going into the trial or not, but also a little bit about their previous experiences of treatment. And patients have generally been very positive about it. Not everyone wants to go into it, but quite a lot of patients that we've interviewed are at least saying that they're interested in being put forward for it. We've also done some discussions with staff, including psychiatrists and nurses and other staff involved in the care of people with severe mental illness. And we've had more mixed responses there. So there are some psychiatrists who are very supportive and keen to help and take part, and there are others who are very challenged by it, really, because, of course, long-term antipsychotic treatment, it just is the standard treatment that everyone is given, more or less, who has a problem of psychotic episodes or psychosis or schizophrenia or whatever you want to call it. And I think services feel quite nervous about the idea of trying to help some people get off that. We know there is a risk of relapse when you take people off this medication, and we're hoping to minimize that by doing it very gradually and supporting people as they come off. But the other important point about the Dutch study that I mentioned, and the study that I'm doing is modeled to some extent on the study that happened in the Netherlands, but the other important point about that study was that initially the group of people who were randomized to have the antipsychotic withdrawal program had a slightly higher rate of relapse, although the relapses were generally quite mild. But actually, at the seven-year follow-up, the relapses had equaled out. So the group of people who were on maintenance treatment were getting just as many relapses as the other group. So although in the short term there may be a higher risk of relapse, it seems that maybe in the long term, actually things even out and the risk isn't that much increased. Anyway,
can you distinguish between relapse and withdrawal reactions, part of psychosis?
We've had a lot of discussion about this, and I think that's very difficult, Peter. I'd be interested in your views on that. I would say that with some antipsychotics like clozapine, for example, if you reduce it in some people, they will immediately become symptomatic, and sometimes they start to develop symptoms that they didn't have in the first place, like visual hallucinations and aggression. And that, to me, is a withdrawal reaction. So it comes on quite fast, quite quickly after the drug's been reduced or stopped, and people can become iller than they were to begin with. But I haven't seen that much with other antipsychotics. And with other antipsychotics, often you stop the antipsychotic and people are actually quite well for a while, and then they have a relapse late, you know, down the line. I think that may well still be related to the fact that they've been on long-term antipsychotic treatment, that maybe some things that treatment has sensitized them to have a psychotic relapse. But it's very difficult, I think, to distinguish it from a relapse that might have occurred without being on antipsychotic.
Do you know how Chouinard and Jones figured out this? I mean, they were the ones originally in Canada who were doing the studies, as you know. I'm just telling the folks. They came up with the concept that when you began to take people off drugs, they not only developed a tardive dyskinesia, but I thought fairly early on their psychoses got worse than they had ever been before or somewhat different, and that it was rather rapid, and they developed the concept of tardive psychosis. Have you looked recently at their... I haven't looked recently at their papers to see how soon the people relapsed into psychosis in their studies and got worse.
I can't remember either. What they did is they went back through people's case notes and tried to identify episodes of tardive psychosis, didn't they, or supersensitivity psychosis, as they sometimes called it. I'd have to look back as well.
You're inspiring me to think back. I don't know if you know, Gualtieri in the U.S. did a lot of studies on taking children and adults, I guess, in retarded institutions off of antipsychotics. And he found a severe worsening in behavior very rapidly, which he considered a withdrawal reaction from the drugs. I noted in one of your articles, about withdrawal, that you were not as convinced that the withdrawal syndrome was as strong as it seemed to me often be.
Well, I don't clinically. I mean, I reduce medication and sometimes stop it, you know, clinically in my patients from time to time. And I've not seen a very distinctive picture that I would say is antipsychotic withdrawal. Certainly sometimes people get more symptomatic. People get anxious. Sometimes people don't sleep very well. But overall, I haven't found that those problems are very significant.
What about nausea, which would be a physical sign that goes along with it?
Sorry?
What about nausea, which would be a physical sign, and even vomiting, that goes along with the withdrawal because you're also unmasking the vomiting center?
Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking now that, of course, when I do it, I'm almost always taking people off very gradually, and this might, you know, so you don't see really a very florid withdrawal picture. And the situations I mentioned, clozapine, of course, sometimes you have to stop clozapine suddenly with people because clozapine is an antipsychotic that can cause this dangerous blood abnormality. So sometimes it has to be stopped suddenly. And in addition to that, clozapine is a very short-acting drug anyway. So that might be why I've only seen this very florid picture with people who've previously been on clozapine. And then I have seen people go into a state where they become, you know, behaviorally disturbed and more psychotic than ever and have visual hallucinations, which they, you know, are more unusual to have in ordinary schizophrenia and may well be a chemical effect, I think.
Yeah.
So it may be that most of the time, you know, we're trying to take people off gradually that prevents this happening. But it's a very difficult area, isn't it? Because I think as well as a withdrawal reaction, I think there's some way in which the drugs probably sensitize people to have a relapse of something that they are already prone to.
Yes, I think that's so.
Make them more vulnerable, yes.
It reminds me of mania, where you see patients who develop mania on amphetamines or stimulants, and at least for a while, they may have manic episodes that aren't necessarily provoked by the drugs. But again, it's all very difficult to determine.
Yeah. Yes, no, absolutely. And of course, mania is with lithium treatment. the discontinuation of lithium treatment provoking mania is the best example, I think, of the way that a treatment can make people more vulnerable to have a relapse of an underlying condition. So there are two or three, you know, quite good studies that have shown now that people who stop lithium are more at risk of having a relapse of their mania than they were before they went on to the lithium in the first place. So the
yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because people don't know about that, and people in our audience may not know about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, lithium seems to be going through a bit of a revival at the moment. There are a lot of people saying very good things about it and saying what a great drug it is. And my reading of the literature is that it may reduce the incidence of manic episodes while you're taking it, because it is a very neurotoxic, sedative, neuroinhibiting drug, isn't it?
Yes.
But when you take it away, I think you put someone's nervous system into really quite a vulnerable position, and they are, you know, at risk of having a manic episode, probably because their nervous system is so overstimulated by the removal of this very sedative substance.
Yeah, I think that's it exactly. Yeah. And it's very, very important, but people can, what happens is doctors then tell them, see, you're manic depressive, you need the drug, rather than you're going through withdrawal. If we can get through this, you may not have any more manic episodes.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, and so, I mean, you know, there are some papers that suggest that the people with manic depression have more episodes now than they did before the introduction of modern treatments like lithium. And if that's the case, I think what that's showing is exactly what you're saying, that actually, you know, by giving people these treatments, we're actually sensitizing people to to have more episodes, and people try and come off and they have an episode and we say, oh, you know, look, there you are, you've had another episode, you definitely need the medication, whereas actually the episode may have just been precipitated by coming off the medication in the first place.
Oh, I have no doubt about it. I've been around long enough now to tell you that when I was in my training in the 60s, we might see one or two people with a manic episode every year in an acute treatment hospital that had several hundred people in it, and we would hold a grand rounds and discuss it.
Yeah.
Whereas now probably half the patients or two-thirds are called bipolar on any psychiatric ward. And the other thing, we never saw mania as a deteriorating disorder, which you see all the time now. We never saw one episode after another episode. I don't think I ever saw that. And now, I mean, I see patients who have, you know, maybe they got... were taking amphetamines at one point, had a manic episode for the first time, and have now had six of them in the 5 years or something. And throughout the whole period, they've been on drugs that cause these episodes, like antidepressants. Mm-hmm. So you're giving bipolar people, i.e. people you think have both depression and mania, you give them the antidepressants, the stimulants, and you're shoving them into manic episodes. So I think it is a gross change clinically, and what we're seeing in the world today from the way Kraepelin described it in 1899, which was unlike dementia praecox or schizophrenia, this was not a deteriorating disease, and people could have manic episodes years and years apart and function very well in between and then go on and function again. And we don't see this so much anymore because people are deteriorating on the neurotoxins. I have no question about it.
I also think, though, that bipolar disorder has become a label for people who are having general difficulties in life, hasn't it?
Yes, and especially children, which is a crime.
Yes, yes. And
has that happened in Great Britain?
Then they get started on one drug after another, none of which, of course, are of any use, and may just compound the problems, as you say.
Yeah. Are you seeing in Great Britain... what we had here with Joseph Biederman, who was the chair of a Harvard Department of Pediatric Psychopharmacology. If you want to find a monster, find somebody who's chair of a Department of Pediatric Psychopharmacology. He was taking money under the table. I blew the whistle on it early, and then later Senator Grassley got a hold of it and found a lot more.
Yeah.
But he was taking money underground, you know, from Johnson & Johnson, who took over Janssen. And we're selling Risperdal to children, and he's the one that got bipolar disorder going in the U.S. so we could give antipsychotics to kids.
Yeah.
Did you have a similar phenomena in Great Britain?
I don't think so, Peter. I'm not a child psychiatrist, but I think we probably use far fewer medicines in children in this country, although it may well be creeping up a bit. But, I mean, Biedermann was doing trials, which he published as well in the mainstream literature, on very young children, giving them antipsychotics. Basically, it was all dressed up as treating bipolar, but basically this was just behavioral control just to quieten kids down, wasn't it? So I don't think we've got that order of things going on. I hope that we are not treating that many sort of four-year-olds. So there were in one of his studies, weren't there?
We got two-year-olds coming out of Boston, on these drugs.
Yeah. But sadly, we do tend to head in your direction. So I expect that rates of use of drug treatments in children are going up along with adults. Although sadly, we don't catalogue our prescription information by age, so it's difficult to get that information.
Did you want to say more about your drug withdrawal program? I had a question that could get us back into it, which is, how in the world are you going to deal with the placebo control arm when people are going to, I think, begin to have reactions that are withdrawal related?
So it's not going to be placebo controlled. It won't be blinded. So the people in the withdrawal arm will have a gradual and flexible withdrawal. This is what they did in the Netherlands.
Yeah. That makes more sense.
Organized by their psychiatrist, if someone starts to have bad withdrawal reaction or an increase in symptoms or just gets very, very anxious, it can be slowed up. And they can have additional treatment if they need it. And then when they stabilize it, they can carry on reducing if they're happy with that. So that's the idea of how it will work. I think it would be difficult to, many placebo-controlled trials were done, withdrawal trials were done, but I think it would be difficult to have a nice gradual one that actually, helped people manage their symptoms as they went along if you used a placebo.
Yeah, I couldn't imagine how you would do it, and that makes sense to me that you wouldn't. All you have to demonstrate is that a significant number of people can be taken off their meds and removed from exposure to one of the world's worst neurotoxins, and you've accomplished something.
Yeah, well, the difficulty is, the worry is that it'll be the patient's ordinary psychiatrist who will be doing this reduction. So one of the worries is that people might be a bit timid and might, if patients, have a bit of anxiety or say they're not sleeping, then the psychiatrist might use that as an excuse to say, we'll just stop the reduction. So that's a disadvantage of having it as an open trial, but we'll hopefully encourage people to do it.
Is the government going to provide any supportive services? Because I think myself that the success of such a program, these are going to be outpatients, right? That the success of such a program requires family involvement and family support, because families panic because of what they've seen their relatives do before. They panic at over drug withdrawal. Is there going to be a program for the family?
There's not going to be a special program, but people who are in services for people who have severe mental health problems in the UK get a fairly good service, and mostly the families would be involved. There would be community nurses or social workers in touch with the family and involving them all the time. I think it'll be, if family members are very opposed to it, it'll be difficult to to do it, but hopefully we can, you know, as the teams that are working with the patients can reassure families and provide them some extra support while it's happening. I agree.
I think it's absolutely critical. I mean, I would really urge you to focus a lot of attention on the family support. You know, I do a lot of drug withdrawal in my practice, and family support makes or breaks it, especially with young people who are dependent on their families. It literally makes it or breaks it. So
I think that's a good point. I think it's also the attitude of services is really important, isn't it?
If
professionals are positive and optimistic about it, it's much more likely to succeed than if professionals are very, you know, anxious and negative and, you know, don't be silly, you can't possibly come off your medication, you would just relapse. You know, that sort of situation, it makes it difficult to succeed.
You know, in our country, we have so many patients who are on these drugs who are not deeply disturbed. And sometimes I find that that some of them, especially if they're, you know, under 40 or 50, that they can really come off without a lot of trouble. Mm. It's the people who have been, you know, exposed to multiple psychiatric drugs for years and years and years and years and don't have supportive families. But in our country, we do see a lot of people who are really high functioning and should never have been put on these drugs. And I've seen, you know, some of them come off with relatively little problem.
Yeah. Well, that's reassuring.
No, absolutely. But you'll probably be working with people who were put on for at least more or less the approved disorders by the government.
Yes. It will be people with an official diagnosis of schizophrenia or a similar sort of psychotic diagnosis.
Well, I hope the family will either get videos or some nice, beautiful handouts or something that lets them know the importance of coming off and the risks of TD and atrophy why it really matters. Are you planning that?
Well, we've got some literature for patients that we could show to families. I mean, what you're making me think about is we have a very supportive family member on the management board of the project, and maybe we need to talk to her about some ideas about what would be helpful for the family, because that's a good idea, that maybe we have some sort of leaflet to explain to them why we're doing this study, why it's important.
Yeah. Well, let me know if I can have any input to that. I'm not asking for my name to get mentioned, which would be the end of the study, I'm sure. But I'd like to be able to help this work. And I do think the family is the key.
Yeah,
and there are people around this world, including in the U.S. and some in Great Britain who've been in touch with the Finnish program, which I hope my listeners now know about, you know, which was a family intervention program that helped young psychotic individuals, mostly without drugs, recover remarkably well. And it's the family that is key in that process.
Yes. No, that's a really good point. You're making me think that, yes, we should maybe produce a leaflet at least for them.
Good.
That would be helpful. Thank you. I just want to mention the name of the study, actually, so that people know the name. So it's called the RADAR study, and that stands for Research into Antipsychotic Discontinuation and Reduction. So I hope that people will hear more about it as we go along, and we'll hopefully have some interesting findings to report fairly soon.
Are you one of the principal investigators? What's your role in it?
Yeah, I'm the chief investigator.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful.
Yeah, it is wonderful that anyone gave me money to do that. But also what's wonderful is I have an enormously supportive team, which includes some very eminent British psychiatrists who've been very supportive to me. So that's going to be helpful.
That's good. Yeah. Is there any chance of getting before and after neuropsych testing?
We are doing that. We are doing
good.
That. I thought it was really important because the Dutch study did neuropsych testing, neuropsychological testing, so to, again, to test people's cognitive abilities, people's learning ability and memory functions and things like that. They did it at 18 months after, during their trial, and they found a difference at 18 months between the group that was randomized to antipsychotic maintenance and the group that was randomized to this gradual antipsychotic reduction and discontinuation. So we've included some neuropsych tests.
Do you have randomization comparator group too?
Yes, and it'll be randomized, properly randomized, yeah.
So you have a control.
So the control will be people who are on maintenance treatment, who carry on maintenance treatment.
Yeah.
So it should be a really informative study and should really give us, you know, some good data on what happens when you try and take people off these drugs in a, you know, gradual and responsible way, rather than all the old studies that just took people off overnight, more or less. And of course, you know, of course, many of them are going to have problems. And the other difference is that we've got a fairly long follow-up. It's going to be a two-year follow-up initially, but actually we hope in the future we'll be able to follow up people for longer than that. And we're not just focusing on relapse. The main outcome is people's functioning.
Joanna, we've got about a minute left. Let me say that we're talking with Joanna Moncrief. She's just, well, you can tell. She's a marvelous, caring, empathic, brilliant, marvelous psychiatrist out of Great Britain and a friend of mine. And her latest book is The Bitterest Pill, and it's about the story of the antipsychotic drugs. She has an earlier book on the myth of the biochemical imbalance. What was the exact name of that one?
The Myth of the Chemical Cure.
The Myth of the Chemical Cure, an excellent book. These are books I recommend. If you've found use in my books, you will definitely find Joanna Moncrief's books useful in the same or a similar fashion, and you may not have heard me say that much before. She and Bob Whitaker, and now Peter Gerche out of Denmark, are really, really doing some very, very good research and thinking about psychiatric drugs. And it's so great that this is going on now. A parting thought, very parting. We probably have about 20 seconds. Nope, we don't have 20 seconds. Joanna, thank you for being on the show.
It's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been wonderful to talk to you. Bye-bye now.
Thank you. Bye.